The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org.
Introduction. Al Harrisman is director of the Center for Integrity in Business at Seattle Pacific University and the publisher of Ethics Magazine, which you can also found at ethics.org. He spent 32 years at a Boeing company, where he retired in 2001 as director of mathematics and computing R&D. He has been involved in global business missions with InterVarsity, co-leading teams in Southeast Asia and Central Africa. He and his wife Nancy live in Bellevue, Washington, where they raised their four children and now spend time with seven grandchildren. It's our great privilege to have Al with us. I'm going to pray for him and then introduce Lyndon. Lord, thank you for having Al be here with us today. Thank you for the privilege that it is to have somebody who spent so much time thinking about the things that we're talking about here. I pray that you would speak through him, that his words would land in our hearts in the place that you desire them to go, that we might fully bring your purposes to bear and open our workplaces. Lord, I pray that his words would bring you great glory and honor, bring him great satisfaction, great meaning and guidance for us in our lives. In your name. Well, thank you. It's a real privilege to be here. I'm excited about doing this story. If you came with the expectation that I'm going to tell you exactly what to do and give you all the answers, you can leave now. It's all over. This is a very complicated issue. In fact, I probably will make it a bit more complicated for you as I introduce a way of thinking about ethics that's more than just solving the tough problems, although it certainly includes that. So, let me take you to the headlines. I just pulled a couple of these out of the paper just to give you a flavor of what's going on in our world. In India, there's a concern about dealing with child labor, and there's an article about Raju, who's a 10-year-old, who's working at night trying to make a living for himself and for his family. Or there's a story that comes out of Asia with bribery associated with the steel mills. Or some of you probably saw the special issue of the New York Times, October 29, on the front page. It talked about looking at the work in Africa through the eyes of a 6-year-old who's a full-time employee and how he feels about his work. These are all issues that we have to be confronted with as we think about the opportunity of doing business as missions. In fact, if you find yourself going off to a third world country, a country that is not developed, a country that has very little in the way of law and support, you're going to find there's all sorts of hardships. I'm not trying to discourage you at all, but what I am saying is this, that you think it's tough to start a business yet in the West, try starting one in a place where you have to deal with some of the issues that I'm going to define. How do we as Christians think about these issues? What is it that we should do? And that's what I would like to share with you today. So I'm going to give you five general themes as we go through this. First, I'd like to just say a little bit about my own background in this, because I'm not the final expert for sure. I'm struggling with this along with you, and I want to share with you where I am and where I'm coming from. You'll find a lot of illustrations and stories as I go through this, because certain experiences that I've had reflect on what I want to tell you. But this is not an all-inclusive story at all. Then I want to define a set of challenging issues for you. And I'm going to do this through anecdotes, through some statistics, through some data, to show you here are the issues that you would face if you would decide, for example, to start a new business, in the Central African Republic. Now, I'm just curious, do any of you know where the Central African Republic is? A couple of you. Usually when I ask that question, people say, oh, you've been in the Central African Republic. Which country have you been in? They think of Central Africa as a general term. So, some of the challenging issues. Then I'm going to cover what I think ethics is all about. I'm going to ask you that question first. But we need to set up the problem and then talk about the tools. And then I'd like to apply those tools against the problems that I introduce. And then out of that, I would like to extract a few general principles to talk with you about. So let me say a bit about my own background and experience. I've had the opportunity over the last 6 years since I left the Boeing Company to be connected with John Terrell and InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. So John and I have taken teams to Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Singapore, that part of the world. Through some other contacts, I've been in China and Hong Kong and talked about business ethics in that part of the world. And then last summer, we took a group of students to the Central African Republic. And we've explored the opportunity of economic development there. All of these have shaped the way I think about this. In addition, I've been publishing Ethics Magazine now since 1998. I started that before I left the Boeing Company with approval from the ethics group at the Boeing Company, incidentally, to do this. Just wanted to make sure you knew that. And in publishing this magazine, what we try to do is publish in a secular language issues that are founded in biblical principles. And I try and find people that are struggling with some of the same issues, but often very senior level people. The next issue that comes out in March will feature a discussion I had just a couple weeks ago with the chairman of PepsiCo and some of the ways they think about this of working in a multinational company in various parts of the world. So my background deals with teaching business ethics at SBU, publishing ethics, studying these issues, going on these trips. But I am not a 20-year person who's done a business mission in another country. So as a result, I may be naive. Some of you can contribute to this story. Let's talk about some challenging issues. And I tried to look at all of them, and I kept trying to narrow this down, and I finally decided I would focus on these six. And I just want to touch briefly on issues of government corruption, child labor, bribery, fair wages, environmental issues, and intellectual property. But there are many, many other issues to deal with. For those of you that are from the West, you will find that the rest of the world sees some of these issues quite differently than we do. Some of them see the issues the same way we do, but the enforcement is different. And that creates a different kind of dilemma for you if you're starting a business in another part of the world. So let me just touch real briefly on these. Some of you have read Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat. Have any of you read that? Interesting book. His book before that, which fewer people seem to read, but which I think is actually better, is called Alexis and the Olive Tree. And in this, he talks about globalization, and he says, in order to make a business work, you need to have these principles in place. Little corruption, legal safeguards, the rule of law, protection for intellectual property, and no secrecy. Now, if you think you're going to go out and start a business in another part of the world, you may have none of these. How will you run a business? Look, for example, at the third bullet, the rule of law enabling contracts to work. Well, in the West, we kind of assume that. We have a contract with someone, and there is a court of law that can adjudicate the result if that doesn't work. What if you're in a country where that isn't true? So, here's a corruption index, corruption perceptions index, published by the Transparency International. And I want you to notice that the darker the colors get going down this red scale, the more corrupt these areas are perceived. And what you can see is a couple of things that will jump off at you. First of all, there's a lot of corruption in the world. Secondly, those of us from the United States will look at this and will say, wait a second, we're kind of the model of of ethics, right? Not really. In fact, the fact that that is dark yellow, if you look into the data, what you see is that one of the good things about some of the countries in the West that are not red is that even though they have ethical problems, they care about them. And that's really, someone from India one time told me that, you know, we've had ethical scandals just like you have, but the difference is that people that lead these scandals are regarded as failures and mocked in the West, whereas in our country, they're heroes. So I think that perception index helps capture some of this data. When we went to the Central African Republic, here's what we found. That on the corruption index, Central African Republic, countries in Africa tend to be rated rather poorly, and the Central African Republic was in a very bad category. Combined with that, the government workers have not been paid for 40 months. Now, this creates a certain challenge for a government worker who needs to feed his or her family on the one hand, and who has a job but no pay on the other hand. This is quite a dilemma. Ease of doing business. There was an agency that ranked companies, and the Central African Republic was ranked 153rd out of 155 countries, which means that you can't really enforce a contract there, and you can't really do business very well there. These are some of the challenges. Okay. I talked with a government leader in Indonesia. We had breakfast together, and he shared with me why it's so difficult to do business ethically in Indonesia. He said, it's tough doing ethical business here. We were ranked the third most corrupt country in the world. Then he paused, and he said, we would have been first, but we bribed the ones doing the survey. And his suggestion was, it's really hard to do business there, and we have to make some changes, he said, speaking for Indonesia, if we want to participate in the global economy. So let's go to child labor. There's incredible data around the problem of child labor, which is an incredibly difficult issue. You can see children in the picture working in various areas. You can go to the web and you can find all sorts of information on what's happening with child labor. But here's some statistics. Working children ages 5 to 14, based on data in 1999 from the World Bank, and you can see 153 million children employed in Asia and 80 million children employed in Africa and others in South America. This is a big problem if you think of setting up a business. Are you going to employ children? How do you do it with the customs and the mores of that particular country? Now, I found some updated 2006 data. They said there's an estimate of 218 working children between ages 5 and 17. 126 million of those are in the worst form of child labor, and I'll talk to you about that in just a moment. And 74 million children under 15 are in such hazardous conditions that this group was recommending that they do something to try and withdraw these children from work immediately. Now, what do we mean by the kinds of conditions? Full-time work at very early age, dangerous workplaces, excessive hours, psychological, physical abuse, very difficult environment of no pay, life on the streets, no access to education so that you can't break the poverty cycle. This is a huge scourge in many parts of the world. Talk about bribery. As I was talking with the same government official in Indonesia, he said a police officer in Indonesia is only paid enough to feed his family for 2 weeks out of the month. And then he said to me, where do you think they get the income to feed their family for the rest of the month? It has to come from some other source. And he said, we have built corruption into our system, and the only change we could make is to change our whole system. When we were in the Central African Republic, we went out of the major city to a few villages, and we encountered a situation like this. I didn't have the nerve to take this picture slightly earlier with the person with the AK-47 rifle standing at the checkpoint. They wanted to see papers, they wanted money. I am told that between the city of Bangui and the border to Cameroon, there are 100 of these checkpoints. Now you say, how can you do business in a country where you can't move goods and services through the country? In fact, there are no railroads in the whole country. There are no navigable rivers enabling moving by ship. There are no ways to move goods. This is one of the barriers that you face in the infrastructure, and bribery is built in as a part of this. Now, we did not ask, were there bullets in the AK-47? I don't know if they could afford them, but they certainly had the rifles, and we weren't going to question. Now, bribery and corruption are very closely related, aren't they? But from the perspective of someone who's going to go in and start a business, you can think about these a little bit differently. You ask the questions in a corrupt environment, am I going to go in there? I'm not going to change the government, so am I going to go in there? How difficult will it be? Is it even possible to do business there? And maybe I make the decision I won't go. Whereas with bribery, if you're there, you have to ask the question, how am I personally going to deal with paying bribes? And it's a huge issue. Fair wages. Sometimes we in the West get real cavalier about this issue. And we look at this and we say, okay, there's a lot of people that are only making a dollar a day. So what are the right wages to pay? I've heard some people say, well, you ought to pay minimum wage in the U.S. Well, that's absurd. It absolutely wouldn't work. But you pay a dollar a day, or do you help people along the way? How do you do this? In Carr, we found that 2/3 of the people live on less than a dollar a day. It's a very, very broken economy. So how do you figure out the right thing to do ethically in paying wages when you're doing business in one of these countries? Here's just a cut that I found on the web that I thought was interesting. Some of you, I've talked to quite a number of people that are in the technology field here. And so here's a technology cut. In the U.S., a programmer makes $60,000 to $80,000, and this is the corresponding amount in various different countries. I want you to observe that there is nothing in here from Africa or Indonesia. That's a different question, and I'll come to that in a moment. Or let's take some other tasks. A telephone operator, $12.57 in the U.S., under a dollar an hour in India, and so on. In fact, for Ethics Magazine, this medical transcription thing, I do an interview with a business leader and I record it on a digital recorder. I download it to my computer, and I used to then make a copy for a woman in my neighborhood who would transcribe this for me. She didn't really like to do the job, but one day I found out about a company in India, and I went to her and I said, you know, I've outsourced your job to India. I now send these documents to India, these digital transcriptions, and I get a document back that I work from. So you can see the impact of outsourcing and globalization here, but you can also see how do you decide what is an appropriate wage. And then, of course, you have to recognize that in much of the third world, this is not an issue because they are not a candidate to do outsourcing. You would not do outsourcing to the Central African Republic for the simple reason that you couldn't enforce the contract. They don't have the skilled labor. They don't have the education system. And so when you start thinking about business in some other part of the world, you have to ask yourself, yeah, I've got the data, and the data looks pretty amazing. 10 to 1, 12 to 1 factors, but now I get to this and I say, I don't even know how to think about it. So there is the issue that in much of the third world, there's no basis for outsourcing. There's no basis for even figuring out this kind of wage. Now, here's a picture of Beijing. This is another ethical issue. How do we treat our environment? In Beijing, you can see all the cranes. They have said that in China, the crane is the national bird, because there is so much construction going on. And yet, you can see the pollution. I was there a couple of years ago, and I remember the day that it rained really hard, and the next day I looked out my hotel, and there were mountains out there that I didn't know were there. And by 2 days later, they were gone. It's very difficult to breathe. It'll be interesting to see what they do with the Olympics in 2008. But how do we think about pollution and environmental issues as we go forward? Here's the Central African Republic. This is walking along a road. These people, their job is to get firewood into the city so they can sell it. They may walk 30 miles with this firewood in order to sell this in the central city. Now, the environmental issues here are that there are very little ways of taking advantage of being efficient with the heat. And so as a result, there's a lot of pollution associated with burning. There's a lot of clear cutting. There's a lot of deforestation going on. All sorts of issues with the environment. This is a woman that was cooking some corn for us, and you can see her working over an open fire out in one of the villages. Intellectual property. You get the idea, don't you? It's a tough issue if you think about how do you deal with this in another country. The person from Indonesia said in response to complaint and protest from the international community, the piracy should be stopped. The police were called in. They entered the schools and offices to capture those with pirated software. This required a payoff to the police, so there is corruption in cleaning up corruption. In other words, they kept their software by paying off the police, so the intellectual property thing wasn't enforced. Yet, you can see it views on itself. In this article from July of 2006, there was an estimate that pirated software in China is about 90% of the software, and music and movies are similar. Bill Gates, of course, has an interest in fixing this up, and he made an estimate that it may take 10 years to resolve this problem, but people think he's being optimistic. So this is a huge challenge in dealing with intellectual property. So, if you're going to start a business in a country that operates differently from your own, you will have to face some issues that perhaps you have not faced before. How do you do it ethically? I think what the question for us is, what should a Christian do in this environment? Before I answer this question, I would like to see if one or two of you would give me a quick response. What do we mean by ethics anyway? Because if we're going to apply ethics to addressing these problems and figuring out what to do, we need to know what we're looking at. So, anyone want to venture a guess of what is ethics?
Behaving consistent with your values and principles.
Behaving consistently with your values and principles. That's good. Anyone else? Yes. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Okay, so an environment of justice, so that laws are enforced, so that people that break them will get, the problem will be addressed. Is that a good summary of what you said? Those are good. And I think that is a very important thing, and what you can see now is that if we say this is what we're going to do, but we say this is the situation, now we have to ask ourselves how we're going to deal with this. I think there's a whole range of solutions, and I just decided to put a few of them up here. One of the things is we could say, well, this is just too tough. We won't do business in this area because we can't act justly. Or another person might say, well, I'll just play the game because I really want to do something. No children employed. We don't do that here. Or, well, let's employ children if it's okay, if it's legal. Or, never pay a bribe. Or, pay a bribe because when in Rome, do as the Romans do. I've heard these statements. You have too. Pay U.S. minimum wage or pay the going rate. What are we going to do? Ignore the environment because the laws are less stringent. In fact, many companies have been accused of setting up factories in countries where they have less restrictive environmental laws just so that they can produce products cheaper and they don't have to worry about the environment. Or, here's a compromise solution I heard from one person. We won't buy pirated software on the street. We'll buy one copy of the software legitimately, and then we'll copy it for everyone in the office. And they thought that was being really honorable. And for many people, this is a big step above their neighbor. So, which approach do we take? I'm going to define ethics in a way that perhaps is a little different, very similar to your words, but I want to use some tools that will help us in just a moment. First of all, ethics formally is the branch of philosophy that deals with the issues of right and wrong in human affairs, right and wrong. We got that part. Business ethics. Some of you perhaps have heard of a book by John Maxwell called There's No Such Thing as Business Ethics. John Maxwell, in that book, didn't know what he was talking about. Okay, I want to put it fairly bluntly so you get my point. The point is that when you start thinking about issues of right and wrong in business, there are lots of things that you have to think about that general principles certainly apply, but how they apply and how you think through them, that's what happens at the intersection. And that intersection is really important. In fact, all intersections are really important. The intersection between two fields of study in school is perhaps more important than the individual fields because some wonderful things happen at the intersection. The intersection of two roads is more interesting than the roads themselves in terms of understanding those interactions. And as I was explaining this to a biologist friend, he said to me, well, duh, the intersection of a sperm and an egg is a baby. That's very different from either one. And so the point is, intersections are very important, and business ethics is the application of this understanding to business. I'm going to break business ethics down into three components. The first one is compliance with the law. Many companies have what is called a compliance department. And believe me, the laws are very, very complex. I worked at the Boeing company. We did work with the government. There are so many laws associated with things you can do and can't do that keeping them all straight is very, very important and very difficult. That's a part of ethics, compliance with the law. But there's another part. Another part is acting appropriately where there is no law. You see, the law is not a sharp enough instrument that it can cover all cases. And so we have things like the smell test. Does it smell right? We have things like the mirror test. Can I look myself in the mirror and feel proud of what I did after I took an action? Or the mom test. Would I tell my mother what I did? These are really good tests to remind ourselves, is this really appropriate? But then, most people stop here, surprisingly, and many ethics classes spend all of their time saying, what's appropriate in this case? What fits with the law in this case? How do I keep from doing wrong? But I like to make sure that in ethics we don't talk just about not doing wrong, but we talk about doing right. You see, it's important to not just avoid the wrong. Any of you that have children know this, don't you? If you give a set of rules to your children and you say you need to follow this, what will they do? What did you do when you were a kid? You found a loophole. Well, you didn't say I couldn't do this, and so you add another rule. Well, you didn't say I couldn't do this, so you add another rule. In our world of business, with technology and globalization, we are encountering situations every day that we didn't even think about 10 years ago. They didn't exist. The law is a backward-looking thing that tries to catch up. We had all the ethical issues in the U.S., and then they passed Sarbanes-Oxley, which is a set of laws to try and govern the behavior that took Enron off track. But that's looking backward. We as Christians, need to look forward. What do we mean by doing good, not just avoiding doing bad? So I like to refer to the first set as damage control. That is, I'll put the compliance with the law and acting appropriately under that. But I also like to think about mission control, and that is doing the good. And if we think about this, so often when we talk about business and business ethics, we get concerned about damage control. Really important. No one wants to spend time in jail. No one wants their company put on the front page of the paper as a model of how not to do business. But mission control is also vital. So I'm going to use these tools in analyzing what we did. I think if you look at most business ethics training, they'll deal with the hard cases. They'll try and avoid doing wrong. But I want to challenge you to look beyond that, to certainly include that, but look beyond it and say, I want to do what's right. Now, I'm reminded of that in the book of James. Perhaps you're well familiar with this verse, but I'd like to make sure that we recall it. If you know somebody who doesn't have any clothes or food, you shouldn't say, I hope all goes well with you. I hope you'll be warm and have plenty to eat. What good is it to say this unless you do something to help? Faith that doesn't lead us to do good deeds is all alone and dead. Now, how does that fit in the context of what we're talking about? The thing that concerns me most is that people will look at the challenges and the problems that are faced with starting a business in some part of the world where they don't have the kind of laws that we would expect to be able to make it easy to run a business, and then to say, well, I could get into all sorts of trouble if I started a business there, so I'm not going to do it. That's safe. That passes the damage control sieve, but it doesn't pass the mission control sieve. It doesn't allow me to do good there. It only allows me to avoid doing bad. In fact, one of the questions, we know that Jesus said to love your neighbor, but we have to ask ourselves this question. In the internet age, who is our neighbor? As we can become connected to many people in different parts of the world, we ask ourselves, who is our neighbor? This morning, I got an email from a colleague that I started having discussions with in Central Africa. Is he my neighbor? I think so. I think he's my neighbor. And so as a result, how do we think about this idea of business as missions? Jesus' call. You know, I find it interesting that often we focus on Jesus coming for salvation, which he certainly did. And that's the ultimate solution to this problem he identifies. But here in Luke chapter 4, he's quoting from Isaiah when he says, the Lord's Spirit has come to me because he's chosen me to tell good news to the poor. How do we tell good news to the poor? If we are his agents, how do we do this? We do it by helping them economically, by helping them overcome the issues of poverty that they're dealing with. And so I think economic development in another part of the world is part of what it is to do good in our world and to follow what Jesus has called us to do. You heard Jeff Van Duzer the first day of the Open for Business track when he said this, but I wanted to pull it out and capture it. This is something we talk about a lot at Seattle Pacific University. God uses business in two different ways that are both really important. One is the creation mandate. The creation mandate is laid out in the first two chapters of Genesis. It's the foundation for creating goods and services in need that the world needs. But it's also the redemption mandate, how to bring healing to brokenness in our world. And business is a vehicle that can address both of these issues. It's not merely a means to some other end. I want to make sure that we're tracking on that point. If we do this in the name of the Lord, it's not just so that we can do something else. Bringing healing and hope to those that are broken and oppressed is a part of what God has called us to do. I think the keys to acting ethically are these steps. And I want to kind of set this up as we go forward into the next part of diagnosing these issues. Sometimes we ask the question, well, what about me? But I believe that the ethical answer often is to move that question, what about we? In America in particular, we are caught with this individualism. I'm a lone ranger. I'm the one that is responsible. And yet, Scripture And much of the rest of the world is better at this than Americans in thinking about community. How do we operate as we? The second thing we do is we try and get very short term. Those of you that have been observing the world over the last 20 years know that the technology revolution has pushed us to shorter and shorter time frames. Everything has to be right now. And yet, if we can move from today to tomorrow, yeah, maybe it won't work out so well today, but how is it in the long term? How do we move that out? How do we know what's right as well as what's wrong? We can study and say this is wrong, but what is right? How do we do that? This means that we need to understand the law. We need to understand customs, where we are going. We need to understand the scriptures. This is our insight as to what's right and wrong. But it also means we need to think about right goals. You know, whether you start a business or not, in another part of the world, you might say, I wouldn't get in trouble if I didn't do that. That's true. But remember, we're not just trying to keep from getting into trouble. What should we do? And knowing what is right includes having the right goals and then the right principles. I loved what the chairman at PepsiCo said to me. He said, one of the challenges that we have is making sure that people do the right thing in the right way. It's not enough to do the right thing. You also have to do it in the right way. So we have to know these principles. Now this raises one other question, which I just wanted to mention very briefly. The question of tent making. Tent making is a very misunderstood term, and so I think we need to be very careful how we use it. Some have argued that since tent making or working for a living, going into another country to get a job so that you could be present in that company, country so you could give out the gospel, is really the answer to in-world missions today. And I think you got to be really careful. I think that tent making could be treating business as though it doesn't really matter. It's only the spiritual things that you're doing while you're there that matters. And I think that that's perhaps a misuse. In fact, it might even be deceptive. It might even become an ethical issue if you say, I'm going to set up a business in another country, and the business isn't real. You're getting supported as otherwise, and you're pretending to do business, but you're not really doing it in order to make a difference. So be careful about that. In fact, I am reminded that Paul is a tent maker. So I went back and I looked at what he said about being a tent maker. And here are some things that I learned. He did it to earn a living. He didn't do it to misrepresent what he was doing there. In fact, I would argue that he was not deceptive at all. He had a very clear picture. He said, I'm called to give out the gospel, but to earn a living, I'm going to make tents. That's great. He was very forthcoming in what he was doing. I also think, and this one I didn't find in the scripture, but I kind of surmised, and you can challenge me on this if you want, but I think he must have done his work well. He must have made good tents. Otherwise, he would have been fired. Okay. So I think the fact is that we want to make sure that we don't just treat our work as a means to some other end and be deceptive about it, but we use our work in such a way that it brings glory and honor to the Lord. So, with these background on ethical principles, I'd like to take a few minutes and look at each one of these issues that I raised earlier and talk about a hint at how we might go about resolving the issues. And then I'm hoping to leave plenty of time so that we can have some interaction. And some of you have had experience in places that I have not, and you could share with me and with the whole group something about that. So let's look at dealing with corruption. I think dealing with corruption is very, very difficult, and I think the second bullet is very important. If there is corruption in a country, it will hold it back. The people in Indonesia were very clear. Corruption has impacted that country. It is very poor, and it's very poor for the very simple reason that they're so corrupt that their goods cost more because everyone has to pay for the corruption, so that as a result they can't develop jobs, they can't develop businesses, and it's really a problem. We need to recognize that. We need to recognize there are no quick changes. I don't think you would go to the Central African Republic and start by saying, let's clean up the corruption first and then start a business.
it'll be lifetimes before that is accomplished. But using the measures that we've just been talking about, I could avoid going to this country and therefore avoid doing bad. But if I want to do good, I may need to go there anyway. And so I think that we shouldn't avoid the opportunity of doing business in a country to bring glory to God, to bring hope to people. And I'm reminded of what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Doing these things to make a difference for the people. Doing these things is a model of what Christ would have done. So it raises the question, well, what did Jesus do? He lived in a corrupt time. He lived in a time when there was an abusive government. He lived at a time when there were horrible taxation systems. Let's look at what he did. Well, he didn't change the tax system in his lifetime. But he did change some tax collectors. Zacchaeus' life was transformed. Levi's life was transformed. But what did he do in the course of his time on earth? He said, render to Caesar what Caesar's. Let's go ahead and pay taxes. Is there corruption involved? Yes. Is he going to solve the whole problem today? No. In fact, I would argue that what Jesus did is he did not endorse the system, but he lived in it. He didn't immediately change the system, but I would argue that he laid the groundwork. The principles of the kingdom of God have transformed the systems. And if you look at the West, where there is less corruption than in other places, it's because of following principles of the kingdom of God. So I would argue that he laid the groundwork, but he did change individuals. And I think the challenge in going into a corrupt environment is to have the grace to do as Jesus did and to recognize that I can't change this overnight. Maybe not in a lifetime, but I can still make a difference in that country. Child labor, how do we deal with that? Let's go back to our model. We need to know the law, first of all, and there are some international laws and there are some national laws. And if you're going to go into a country, you need to understand that. But I'm going to throw out a caution that may sound really horrible to you. I think we have to be really careful about this issue of child labor. Because I think there are some aspects of child labor that are good. Whoops, now I said it. Because in some countries, think about in the U.S., if you know our history. How many of you worked at age 10? I had a paper route, I shoveled sidewalks, I mowed lawns. I had all sorts of things that I did, and it taught me some of the skills. My friends that worked on the farm worked a lot. Not in an abusive situation, but they learned work skills. And I think we have to be really careful. And as I was thinking about this, I was talking to someone I met at a conference from the Netherlands, and he said, let me tell you something about this. He said, here's a paper, and he gave me a copy of this paper. He said, as we think through child labor legislation, he said, the summary of this paper is that the reality that forces poor families to defy child labor laws raises doubts about whether this legislation is even successful because of their approach to doing this. Here's a quote within the paper. Although ostensibly aimed at eliminating the exploitation of children worldwide, the passing of the U.S. Child Labor Deterrence Act of 92 caused thousands of impoverished children to be pushed further into poverty. We have to be really careful here. Let me give you one more. This is the same person, Martin Biermans, that told me this story and referred to a UNICEF report. A multinational company had been working with a factory in Thailand which had child labor. Protests were raised and the factory was shut down. Someone went in and did a survey and found that 40% of those children a year later were engaged in prostitution. You see, when we think about stopping something rather than doing something good, we might think just stopping this is a good thing. Why don't we look forward? And as he told me this story, I said, you know, that reminds me of something Jesus said. He said, when an evil spirit comes out of a man, it goes through arid places seeking rest and doesn't find it. And then it says, I'll return to the house I left. And he arrives and finds the house unoccupied, swept clean and put in order, and goes and takes it with seven other spirits more wicked than itself. Sometimes when we clean up something but we don't have a plan for something better, what happens is something worse. So I'm certainly not in favor of child labor, but I am in favor of children learning business skills. I am in favor of children being treated as children and getting their education. And so how we walk in this way of helping children have an opportunity to be educated, have an opportunity to learn skills, and not violate the law, this is a very complex issue. And I urge you to think it through carefully rather than just stand there and say, this is bad. Okay? Bribery. You need to know the law in this case because there are some very important laws, especially if you're from the U.S., because there's something called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. But knowing the law is not enough, because as we'll see, the law doesn't cover everything. Here's a summary of the law, and I want to point out some really key points to this. The first one, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act makes it illegal to bribe a foreign government official to obtain or retain business. Illegal. And you can't get around it by working through a foreign subsidiary. You can't get around it by working with a third party. And it even goes on to say it's unlawful to make a payment to a third party while knowing that all or a portion of the payment will go directly or indirectly to a foreign official. The term knowing includes conscious disregard and deliberate ignorance. Okay, that's all in the law. But then there's this really interesting thing in the law. It says there's an exception to the anti-bribery prohibition for payments to facilitate or expedite performance of a routine government action. Interesting. So from the point of view of the law, I couldn't pay to get a contract, but I could pay to get my goods through customs. Now, you might say, wow, we're off the hook. We can pay to get our goods through customs. Wait a minute. Ethics is more than compliance with the law. So what other considerations do we have to make here? I've actually talked with some people in another part of the world. I'd like to share a little bit about how they handle it. The first one is George Ting. George Ting is in Malaysia. He was responsible for developing the KFC franchise in Malaysia, and he grew this from 8 stores in all of Malaysia to about 400. He was a very interesting person. I really enjoyed my conversation with him. He's a strong believer. I said, how do you deal with a bribe? He said, I made a commitment never to pay a bribe, facilitation payment, or anything else. This is my Christian faith and belief. He said, let me tell you a story. Every time I open a new restaurant, the health department comes to me and they say, before we give you a health permit, you have to pay this fee. He says, I won't do it. So he opens his restaurant anyway, and they fine him. The law says they can only fine him once. Then he smiled and he said to me, you know, the fine is less than the bribe. So this is the way I've chosen to operate. This is one person's conscience. This is how he developed that solution. Second person is Dato Loy, also in Malaysia, also running a large business in Kuala Lumpur. He said, you know, as a Christian, I try to avoid paying a bribe, but I also have to do business. And sometimes I pay a facilitation payment. He said, I don't like to do it. I know it holds our country back because in the long term, as long as that practice is there, it's going to keep that country from being competitive. But I feel that I can do that. I don't know if you agree with him or with Dato Ting, but those are two perspectives. A third person is from Indonesia. Tougher place than Malaysia. In fact, they refer to Malaysia as a Western country when they're in Indonesia. And he said, he's not a Christian. He's a very moral man and one that I have enjoyed getting to know over a period of several years. He said, my goal in my company is to be a clean glass of water in a dirty river. He said, inside my company, I'm going to do everything I can to act ethically in government, but I can't clean up the whole river. And so I have to do what I have to do. That was his conclusion. I would urge you to not take any of these conclusions, but to use some ideas. Make sure, first of all, that you avoid rationalizing. This is what I want to do, therefore I'll take this one. Don't back into it. In Romans it says, if you say, let us do evil that good may result, their condemnation is deserved. Let's not be rationalizing this thing. But let's think through it really carefully. And I'm going to give you some tools for thinking through it in just a moment. Fair wages. Again, we have to think through these three pieces. Applicable law, acting appropriately, and doing good. What is the right thing to do? Again, I've talked to several people. Theodore in the Central African Republic is a Christian man. One of the few people that we encountered that had actually started a business that employed people. In the whole capital city of Bangui, we found 8 registered businesses. Theodore has 6 people. He said that his wage for people is about $60 a month. Not very much, but fair compared to what other people are getting. He struggled through a compromise, looking at the competition, looking at what it takes to sell, looking at living prices, and tried to come to a conclusion. When I talked to Martin Biermans, the one I mentioned from the Netherlands earlier, he said one of the situations he encountered was an employer decided he'd be really very gracious and he'd pay a lot more than the base wage, and he found the workers didn't show up every Friday because they'd been paid for the whole week working through Thursday, as far as they were concerned. So you've got to be really careful about the way things work out. Here's another one that may surprise you. I spent some time with the CEO of Starbucks, Oren Smith, and he made this comment. He said, look at the second paragraph. Our farmers need to be able to sustain quality production and make a living. If they don't, they'll probably go into some other trade and won't raise coffee. So that's the self-serving argument. And then he says it's hard to say that we ought to squeeze one more penny out of the worker so Western countries can enjoy a cheaper cup of coffee. So they pay much more than minimum wage in the country. They have tried to go in and understand what a living wage is, and they pay that to their coffee growers. A really good model, I think. Don Seitzma, he worked in Nepal, and he said when they hired Sherpas to carry equipment up to the top of the mountains, their telecommunications company, he said, we decided on $3 to $5 a day was about the right amount, and we had lots of workers who wanted to do that. And then, going back to the other point, he said, there's a law that the Sherpas have to be 18, and there was this young man that came to work, and he said, I couldn't believe he was more than 16 or 15, but he said he was 18. I didn't know what to do. He said, I went ahead and hired him. He was delighted to do the job. He did really well. I don't know if I did the right thing or not. This is another Christian brother who has a business in Nepal, and it shows the kind of struggle in the real world when you're dealing with this on the ground. I think we need to do this as it relates to this subject, but many others. We do need to understand the law. We need to understand the customs. But I would encourage you, if you're going into a business, to find a group of Christians that you can meet with and talk about. Make sure that you understand the cultural involvement of that particular country. And then don't forget why you're there. If you're there to raise the economic standards and help create jobs, then I think having clear objectives of what you're doing will help you in dealing with this issue. And don't just think about this as bringing a solution from the West. Environmental issues. I don't think the law is very helpful here, our first criteria. So let's go to the second one, what's appropriate. And I would just challenge you to say, how do you build a sustainable business someplace in another part of the world? Don't say, I can get by with polluting the environment. It does all come back to us, remember. But the fact of the matter is, polluting the environment is not the right way to take care of the earth that God has entrusted us with. So think about how you can create a sustainable and pollution-free environment. Be a leader in this area, even if that isn't true in the other country. My experience at Boeing in this area has really colored my feeling on this. I remember when a law was passed that outlawed one of the chemicals that we have been using as a regular cleaning solvent in the manufacturing process. Everyone was up in arms, you know, this is going to drive our costs through the roof, it's going to be horrible. They put a group of scientists together to work on this problem, and it wasn't long before they found a solution that not only was environmentally safe, but cheaper. I think creativity here around the environment can drive people, and it's too easy to just say, well, let's burn the wood. Let's not think about creating something that will be more protective of the environment. Intellectual property. This one's a bit different. I think there are laws almost everywhere that deal with intellectual property, but it's a problem of enforcement, and as Christians, I think we need to think through this very carefully. I read a lot of stuff on the internet about this one, and I kept seeing this recurrent theme. Why should I pay for Microsoft software because Bill Gates is rich enough? You know, that's a neat thing to say, and it's irrelevant. The fact of the matter is, the question is, what is the price of the software? If I don't want to use it, I can do something else. And Microsoft is also stuck with the fact that there is now open software. There are creative solutions that you can look at that allow you to stay within the law around intellectual property and don't require you to pay for software. Think it through as creatively as you can. Don't just say, I can cut the law because it's not going to be enforced. Here's another challenge that we found in the Central African Republic. And I found this in a number of places. Some people say, well, if only we could get people to trust in Jesus, that would change things. Well, what we found is that CAR is 30 to 80% Christian. You might say, well, that's an incredible range. It is, because in many of the poorest countries in the world, there is really no data. So you interview a bunch of people and you hear these things and then you figure out as best you can. Even the capital city of the Central African Republic, you can look at about 12 websites and you can see that the population is somewhere between 500,000 and 825,000. Nobody really knows. But in the Central African Republic, person after person told me the church teaches people to believe in Jesus, but says nothing else about being successful on earth. My colleague, who was with us, preached in the church in the Central African Republic and talked about the scourge of AIDS and how to think about that as a believer. And he said people told him afterwards that it was the first time AIDS had been mentioned in the church, even though every family in the church had been touched by AIDS. It's a kind of a personal salvation that doesn't deal with the bigger issues. The idea of thinking of a economic development seminar coming through a church, thinking of the words of Jesus that he's come to bring hope to the poor, just isn't done. And then I added parenthetically, of course it's not done in the West either. We don't talk much about business's mission within our churches in the West, and that's also a problem. The irony is that we found the Muslims were coming into the Central African Republic with a message of wholeness. They had the mosque in the center of the marketplace. They had jobs, they had education, other kinds of things. They were thinking about the issues holistically. Certainly we as Christians should be doing the same. So let me extract a few general principles and then let's take some questions. Understand the law, understand appropriate behavior, and do good. The three parts of the lesson. What does doing good mean? I'm going to give you something. I'd love to spend more time with it, but I'll just put it up there, and I would be glad to get a copy of this for you. Here are eight principles that I think are helpful in doing good. Be open and transparent. I'll tell you where to find this on a website in just a moment, so you don't have to write it down. Be accountable, but don't be afraid to take risks. Work as hard as you can to do it right, to be excellent, but know that everything won't turn out perfectly. We're in a broken world, so be good at handling mistakes. Have utmost integrity, work with others, and recognize things won't always go well and have courage in the face of difficulty. Here are eight principles. I would challenge you to kind of think through these carefully. Now, you can find them on our website at ethix.org under Tools, Eight Traits of a Healthy Organizational Culture. You'll find them this way. Or you can find them in a quite different form. In Matthew chapter 5, the Beatitudes, Jesus said in the first Beatitude, blessed are the poor in spirit. We've translated poor in spirit to be open and humble. Blessed are those who mourn, accountable for what they do. Fourth one, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, and blessed are the merciful, etc. So this is a translation of the Beatitudes. I think a great tool for helping you think through what it is you're trying to accomplish. And don't forget the last one. It won't always work out well. Having courage in the face of difficulty. These are six women that came to see us. They had started a business in the Central African Republic. They heard we were in town to talk about economic development, and they came to see us. They spent an hour with us describing their one-year plan. They described the fact that they had taxed themselves a very small amount, they had no money at all, to start a business. They were now making soap and tomato paste. They now had a bank account. And in that folder, the woman with the glasses showed us, we have a one-year plan of how we're going to develop new products. And we said, wow. In spite of all the brokenness, business was going on. Have courage, you can do it. At the end of the meeting, I couldn't help myself when I said, you come from a village that's 8 miles away. Tell me, how did you get here to see us? And they said, we walked. And I said, how are you going to get home? And they said, we'll walk. They walked 16 miles to spend an hour with us to talk to us about economic development. When you go to a country where there is brokenness, you will find people that, in spite of all the odds, are going to do something. Have courage and work with these people and help them to flourish. And they're everywhere. This picture I took in the middle of the meeting, it's on the front page of the ethics copy that you got in your folder. And it's a reminder to me of why we're doing this. We're not doing this because it's fun or it's easy. We're not doing this to avoid having problems. We're doing this to bring hope to people that have very little hope. These children had gathered around the door of the place where we were having a meeting and just looked in. And literally, I was sitting in this meeting on a dirt floor, sitting on a chair, and I turned to the side and I took the picture and I turned back and went on with the meeting. I didn't know I had this picture until I got back. And I put it in front of me all the time to say, why are we doing these things? And I would encourage you, yes, it's difficult. Yes, there are huge ethical issues. Yes, some of them are going to be really tough to deal with, and when you deal with them not quite the right way, some of your friends will criticize you, but have courage. Use the tools, address the issues, but go forward. Ethics is not just about avoiding doing bad, it's about doing good. Let's take some time for questions. Someone has a microphone over here. We'd like to capture what you have to say. We'll talk, we have about 7 or 8 minutes, and I'd be glad to talk with you afterwards if you want to stick around.
Do you think your definition of ethics was about right and wrong? And I think most of the Western world think like that, and if you look at East and Asia, Middle East, people think of in the basis of shame and honor.
Yes.
So I think there is a cultural difference. You know, when we go and impose our Western ethics and Christian, Judeo-Christian ethics, and so even if you look at the church that is flourishing in the so-called third world, you know, if you want to collaborate with them, there you will find that kind of mentality in the church. And also, you find the recent November issue of Christianity that talks about how Pentecostal and Charismatic churches are flourishing in the third world, and there is an emphasis on 90% of these believers' churches believe in prosperity theology.
Right.
So there is even finding the church teachings lacking what's true about the gospel, you know, cost. Cost of the call. So
right.
So we have a difficult situation.
Absolutely. That's a very, very good point. Sometimes shame can correlate with wrong, and honor can correlate with right. Not always, but to the extent that the Word of God is written on people's hearts, you can find that there is some correlation there, so you can use that language, although it isn't perfect. Sometimes people think something's honorable that we would think is wrong, so you have to be really careful there. Good, very good point. Other question? Back here. First of all, a living wage would be what it takes for a person to actually live, more than survival. You know, can they feed their family? Can they house their family and so on? Not in luxury, but... And this is the study that Starbucks had done, for example, in some of their coffee-growing countries, and it determined the price that they needed to pay in order for people to be able to live as opposed to survive. And I think a fair wage might be considered a wage that... that people are willing to work for, but a living wage is maybe a little different from that. What was your third question again, please? The economic impact of overpaying. I think one of the challenges of overpaying is that perhaps if you could overpay everybody to the point of raising the level of a whole community, perhaps that would be less of a difficulty. But when you overpay a few people, money does funny things to people. It really does. It causes us to think we're better than someone else because we have more money. And you can do that to a community. You can cause a person who is much more wealthy than their neighbor to all of a sudden think that they're superior to their neighbor. And I think that that can create a huge problem within a community. In fact, one of the things that we found in the African community where we were, it may not be universally true, and it may also be true in other places, is that rather when someone does well, instead of rejoicing with that person, the goal is to pull them down to their level because they want to keep people at the same level. So it creates all sorts of tensions. I just think that trying to understand how to do this as an overall system is a very important concept. And I think there are a lot of companies that are trying to study this and understand it. Question up front.
The old saying that, you know, with your hammer, all problems look like nails. Is there something about situations like, you know, CAR where there's almost two problems? One is they don't have concept of Western capitalism with rule of law and whatnot, and at the same time, there's also an issue of it's a broken world and Jesus is known in name but not fully. Is it really a business issue, or is there a deeper issue that we're?
There's no question it's a deeper issue, but I was coming at it from the point of view that if you're going to start a business, how do these issues affect you? They affect the rest of the society. There are other big problems. As you mentioned, the whole idea of the prosperity gospel, the idea that I accept Jesus as my Savior, but it has nothing to do with what happens on Monday. Those are huge issues, but they affect the business issue. So my thinking here was to raise the question, how do these issues affect us if we're thinking of creating a business in that part of the country, part of the world? Another one back there, one over here. Yes, over here first.
So I think you touched on a lot of great points for living in foreign countries and dealing with issues in developing countries currently. I'm just wondering, with your experience at Boeing, do you have any tips around the biblical principles for managing people in a managerial position, how to treat the people who work for you and for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. In fact, for those of you that if you know what I've been working on, you would think I planted that question. If you go to ethics.org, we have 10 principles for a highly ethical business leader that talks about how to treat people well. And there are 10 principles that are laid out there. And let me tell you just a couple of them. And then I would refer you to that website. The first one is that you should treat people in a one-on-one relationship. If you're a manager of a group, you shouldn't just think of the group. You shouldn't think of them as numbers, but you should think of them as individuals. Another thing is you should give people room to grow and change, to develop as people. You should encourage their education. Another thing is you should pay people fair wages. Another thing is you should create a safe working environment. Another thing is you should be open and honest in your communication with them about how the situation is. If you look very carefully at the 10 principles of highly ethical business leaders and read the 10 commandments, you will see a very strong parallel, because the first commandment is have no other gods before you. And if you believe people are made in the image of God, then the first commandment would translate to have no other people before you, literally, or to treat people in a one-on-one relationship. And to not steal would be to pay a fair and just wage, so that you, not stealing would translate to fair pay, et cetera, et cetera. And it's laid out there, and I'd be glad to talk to you more about that.
I'm a farmer in Rwanda, and the tank stores there are very good, but I read somewhere that in one African country, if someone paid all the tax, it would have been three and a half times the cumulative revenue of their business. So in that position, how on earth can you go about, you can't respect the laws in that sense, so you know, how do you decide what is a good amount?
Yeah, that's a horribly difficult problem. Because if you follow, it's kind of like you've probably seen the joke in the U.S. about the short IRS form, how much money did you earn, send it in. You know, it's worse than that, I guess. And in Italy, there's something called the tax law, where it's a negotiation. There are no rules. In fact, if you pay what the government asks you to pay, you would vastly overpay. And so I think you have to be wise there. What I would encourage you to do if you're in one of these countries is spend some time with some people that are believers that have been on the ground and thinking about that problem. I'm from the West. My idea of telling you about that when I haven't been in that situation, I think, would be kind of wasted. I would notice when I did say dealing with the law, there was a parenthetical comment about unjust laws. And the reason I didn't emphasize that is because too often Christians like to focus on unjust laws and use that as a rationalization for not following the law. I talked to someone who told me that he obeys God's laws and not man's, and so he feels it's very fine for him to go 50 miles an hour and a 30 mile an hour speed limit because that's man's law and it's unjust. You really ought to be able to go 50. We as people can rationalize these things, so therefore I don't like to focus on it. But in the situation you described, yes, following that particular law would mean that you could not have a business. So there would have to be some other way of dealing with it. And I would suggest that people in the local economy have figured that out. And talking seriously with other Christians who have encountered that particular law as to the right ways of dealing with it, and in the long term, changing it, is the best thing I can suggest. Yes. I would be happy to ship you the entire slide deck. I'm going to be careful here. I may not have been careful enough to reduce the. It may not go through an email. Give me an email, and I'll find some way to get this to you. Also, I'd like to make mention of the fact that at the SPU booth, and I just brought a couple of these along, if you are interested in ethics, we've got a deal where you can write Urbana across the subscription card and get it for half price. And there's one of those over at the SPU booth in the auditorium in Adams Mark. A subscription to the ethics magazine that I've made mention of in a number of these cases. Anything? One more, or two more, I guess.
Pastors. And in Romania, I think in many non-Western countries, the pastor often is a part-time job. So they work full-time and then they pastor part-time. And what my friend in Romania finds is that many of the pastors are unethical business people. And then they come to the church and preach. And there's this severe disconnect.
what I mentioned earlier when we talk about believing in Jesus but not about what happens every day. I remember, I mean, this has actually been true in the U.S. as well. I heard someone make a comment a few years ago in a meeting I was at. They said, you know, I really love the idea of a Christian Yellow Pages because it tells me who not to do business with. And, you know, it's scary that we think that way. And so as a result, what I think Christians need to do here and in other parts of the world is get together and think very seriously about what it is to do business as a Christian. I'm going to throw in another ad just for the fun of it. In October, we're actually having a conference at Seattle Pacific University asking the question, what if faith really mattered in business? How would you look at accounting? How would you look at leadership? How would you look at human resources? How would you look at negotiations? How would you look at marketing and advertising if faith really mattered in business? And I think it's time that we get serious about this. It's true, and you can look this up. Jesus said more about economic property matters in his conversations than he said about heaven and hell combined. What we do economically matters in the kingdom of God, and we haven't taken it seriously. So I do accept that there's a problem in other parts of the world, but there's a problem in the West as well. And we all need to take it seriously as a Christian community. I think there's one more up here, and then I think we're out of time.
Thanks, hopefully this is a quick question. I'm a student in the United States and most likely will practice business in the U.S., and I wondered if you, in thinking about ethics, have a comment on some maybe questionable ethics that we do here in the United States.
Well, there's certainly lots of it. In fact, 2 weeks ago I spent a couple hours interviewing and having a conversation with Sharon Watkins, who is the whistleblower for Enron. And so, you know, you don't have to think very long to see where the ethical problems are. I think being a Christian in business requires a great deal of courage. I think it's a worthy profession, it's an honorable profession, but I think there's going to be some factors around you that will affect you. Yes, it's true that misrepresenting the expense account, misrepresenting products, all sorts of those kinds of issues we've seen in the headlines. We as Christians need to be salt and light to deal with that. But there's another kind of issue that affects us. Bill Pollard talked about it briefly the other evening. He said, greed affects all of us. And we pretty soon start thinking that the reason we're working is to maximize our paycheck as opposed to doing the work of God. Some places people never thought about the fact that I like to say that I was in full-time Christian service when I worked at the Boeing Company. The Boeing Company wrote my paycheck. People look at me like I got a hole in the head when I say that. But I really believe that if we're going to act that way, it's got to change the way we do things. And I want to be really careful here. That doesn't mean we're perfect. And in fact, someone said to me, well, what happens if you let people know you're a Christian and then you fail? And I said, wow, if you can't fail as a Christian, you can't fail as anybody. I mean, Christianity is all about, our faith in Christ is all about, what do we do? How do we correct things? How do we deal with things? So, absolutely, there's the obvious issues, and then there's the more subtle issues that where we get caught in our culture. How do we deal with both as a Christian in business? And how do we recognize our work is more than just putting in my time at the office so that I can do service later? Dennis Bakke made the interesting comment when he was talking about this. He said, is business a means for mission? That is, I can earn money so I can fund missions. Or is it a platform for mission? That is it a place where I can share my faith? Or is it a mission? Does God care about the work that I do? And I believe it's yes, yes, and yes to those questions. And so, as a Christian, just getting a hold of that can be transforming for us. So being a Christian and acting ethically is more than not doing wrong. It's about doing right. Okay? I think we're out of time. Thanks very much.